The reading is found in Daniel chapter 3, which is on page 894 of the Bibles on your chairs. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits, basically pretty big. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and the herald proclaimed aloud, "You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, as soon as all the people heard the sound of the hornpipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king Nebuchadnezzar. Before the king, Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up."
We're beginning by thinking about how we admire those who stand up for what they believe in against what seems like the whole world. Folk like William Wilberforce, who famously campaigned for most of his life to end the British slave trade, or Martin Luther King, who eventually gave his life in the cause of civil rights in the US. And these are people who stand bravely for the truth, even when it's very, very costly. And one of the things that makes these people even more remarkable is that the truth that they stand for, in their cases, the biblical principle that all people are made in God's image with equal dignity, applying this truth to the culture in the way that they did, which now seems so obvious to us, was actually seen as very weird and extreme in their own day. As human beings, we tend, don't we, to breathe in the ideas of the culture around us, like passive smoking. We hardly notice we're doing it. The French philosopher Simone Weil, who lived through the period of Nazi Germany, she described this tendency we have like this. She said, evil, when we're in its power, is not felt as evil, but as a necessity or even as a duty. And she's describing there how when we're immersed within a culture, it's very hard for us to see the evils within it. So we tend to ask the question, how did most people at the time get taken in by this dreadful lie? But the real question is, how did that tiny minority find the clarity to see through the lie? How did they get to stand for the truth amidst all the confusion? And the second question in understanding these people who stood out against the world is not just how did they find that clarity to stand against the world, but how did they find the courage to do it when the cost was so great? And our passage today, which we just had read, which is talking about the Wilberforces, the Martin Luther Kings of their day in 6th century Babylon, this passage is going to help us with these questions. So the first two points there on the sheets I've put there are, we need to see the false gods for what they are, and we need to know the true God for who he is. So first, we're going to consider the false gods. Now, it's worth saying, if this idea of false gods is new to us, that idolatry isn't just the kind of primitive idea of bowing down to blocks of stone. It's the practice which all of us do by nature, looking to created things to supply what only God can give us, whether that's meaning or security or fulfillment or whatever it is we're looking for. As someone has famously said, it's the practice of making good things into God things, ultimate things. And as human beings, we have this insatiable drive to do this. And what's more, it's actually at the root of everything else that goes wrong in our world. So it's well worth paying attention to and understanding well. And the first thing we see about false gods in this chapter, I've put on the sheets there, is their subtlety. Now this King Nebuchadnezzar, we've looked at him in previous weeks when we were in Daniel before Christmas. He really knew what he was doing. He lived in a pluralistic society, full of all kinds of different religions, different values. How on earth is he going to hold the whole thing together? And the text says he made this huge golden image, which everyone has to bow down to. And the image isn't given a name. It seems it doesn't refer to a particular god. In fact, it seems to represent all the gods and all the values of the culture. So Nebuchadnezzar is not forbidding people from worshipping their own gods. He's saying, in private, you can worship whoever you like. All I ask is that in public, everyone agrees to leave all that behind and that you unite around and bow down to this new system, as symbolized by the golden statue. Of course you can worship your god, so long as you don't say he's the only god to be worshipped. That's what's going to cause the problems. And actually, this kind of approach has been very common in pluralistic societies. So we see it later in the Roman Empire, and of course we see it in our society today. You can have a faith, just make sure that it's safely locked up in private. That's the rule. And I think we end up buying into this public-private distinction without even noticing it. So, for example, in the business world, perhaps everyone around us is ruthless and barely legal. And, of course, there are rivals. So what are we going to do? Well, we decide at work we're going to have to be ruthless, same as everyone else. Privately, we're believers, but publicly, we've bowed to the system. And we see it's the same in all kinds of other areas. The demands of the false gods are very subtle. And often they win their battles by convincing people to just wear different hats in different places. And frighteningly, we often don't even notice when we're doing it. One of the lovely things about children is they give us, don't they, a fresh perspective, a fresh view of the world. I cycle three of our daughters to school and preschool at 8:15 in the morning, and as they cycle down the road, invariably they sing this same song which is "Give thanks to the Lord, our God and King," which we sing here at the Barge. And they sing it very loudly so that all the passers-by at 8:15 in the morning get to enjoy it as well. Now, the issue isn't there that they're disturbing the peace. If they were singing nursery rhymes, I probably wouldn't even notice that they're doing it. But what makes me feel so awkward as they declare God's praises at the top of their voices is the fact that I, at least, have been indoctrinated by the culture. Do you remember that unspoken rule? It's fine to worship God in private. You mustn't mention God in public. And therefore, my instinct when I hear it is immediately I want to shut them up. But I'm pretty sure that Daniel's friends would insist that we mustn't buy into this keep God quiet kind of indoctrination. You see, Daniel's friends could see through the subtlety of the false gods, and they refused to keep their faith locked up in a box marked private. And the second thing we need to consider about false gods in this chapter is not simply their subtlety, but their attraction, their appeal. They look so good. In fact, there's a huge emphasis in this chapter on image, on appearance. This statue is 90 feet high. It's about the height of that Christ the Redeemer statue, which overlooks Rio de Janeiro. But this statue is made almost entirely of gold. And in the ancient world, a golden statue of this size would have just been breathtaking. And then there's a royal dedication with every kind of official invited. There's a huge orchestra to mark the event. And then there's this dramatic, synchronized bowing down, just like those pictures of all the worshippers in Kaaba, the Kaaba box in Mecca. And if we were there, the whole thing would have been deeply impressive. And it's the same, isn't it, with so many of the things that we look to today for meaning and for purpose. It's very obvious here on the wharf. Even the buildings are spectacular. Or that corner office with the plaque on the door. It's all very impressive. And it whispers to us these promises of security and fulfillment. It's the same with human religion. Religion often appeals to the senses, doesn't it? It looks, it sounds, it feels spectacular. Impressive buildings, rituals, music. And if it's done well, the whole thing can just send a shiver down your spine. In the Bible, the whole letter to the Hebrews in the New Testament is written to believers who long for visible priests and visible sacrifices and visible religion. And the writer says, in effect, look, true believers have always been content with faith in an unseen God. Even when it feels weak, even when it feels unimpressive, do not be taken in by the big show. And it's worth thinking in our situation, in what areas do you and I need to hear this message? When is it that we're craving something more impressive? And the final characteristic of false gods I've picked up in this chapter is not just their subtlety and their appeal, but their tyranny, their oppression. I think for lots of people, this sounds like a bit of a surprise. The approach where everyone gets to decide for themselves what they're going to live for, who they're going to trust in, that approach sounds like the perfect recipe for a pluralistic society. So surely idolatry, each of us picking our own gods, will go hand in hand with freedom, not with tyranny. That's what we think. But actually, whenever idolatry is associated with power, which it invariably will be, it leads to enslavement and oppression. And we see that in this chapter as Nebuchadnezzar's tolerance actually only extends to those who bow the knee to his pluralistic idol. And this chapter is then a catalogue of threats, intimidation and coercion that get launched at anyone who won't toe the line. And one of the underlying reasons why idolatry leads to tyranny and oppression is because idolatry is basically a projection of ourselves. 9 times in this section, it's underlined that this is the image Nebuchadnezzar set up. He set it up. He set it up. And the writer's rubbing our nose into the absurdity of a God whom we make. And that's another part of the appeal of idols. We're in charge of them. We craft them to suit our own agendas. But when that happens, the question then arises, who or what is left to stop me from exercising my power however I choose? And of course, the answer is nothing. If I won't acknowledge my loving Creator, then of course I no longer need to hold to the principle that all human beings are made equal in the image of God. That doctrine which was so crucial to folk like Wilberforce and Martin Luther King. So I can actually start picking and choosing who I think is worthy of rights. I might miss out the elderly or the unborn or anyone I think is inconvenient. And I can pick and choose who is worthy of having a voice in society. We actually saw a little snapshot of that in November, didn't we? I don't know if you read that article about what was going on at Oxford University. The students pressured their college to close down a debate on abortion in case some people might be offended. And it's just a clever way of declaring who is and who isn't worthy of having a voice. Without the true God, there'll still be discussion about morality. People will still have opinions about what's right and what's wrong. But morality just becomes a kind of power play where might is right and where the loudest voices will always win. William Penn was one of the founding fathers of the US. He's the guy Pennsylvania was named after. And he said this: nations must be ruled by God or they will be ruled by tyrants. Now that is quite a stark verdict on human beings, but it's one which this chapter vividly illustrates for us. Another way that idolatry will lead to tyranny is the way that idols dehumanize their worshippers. And actually, this is a much subtler form of tyranny, one which we might not be aware of. In the chapter, there's a contrast between the mindlessness of the idol worshippers when compared with the thoughtful maturity of Daniel's friends. So the idol worshippers, they gather, they're threatened. And then sure enough, in verse 7, like Pavlov's dogs, as soon as the music plays, their noses are in the sand and their backsides are in the air. And it all works like clockwork. And this behavior is then contrasted in the chapter with the grown-up response of Daniel's friends. Part of being a grown-up human being is learning that there are times to say yes and there are times to say no. And in verse 16, the friends don't join in with the automaton robots all around them. The friends say no. And we see examples all around us, don't we, of how idolatry turns people into effectively mindless automatons, robots. Ring the bell of suffering and out comes, that's not fair. Ring the bell of, I'll give you a task and out comes resentment. Ring the bell of, I've got something you haven't, and out comes envy. Idols degenerate people into giving these mindless Pavlovian responses. If we'd been reading from the beginning of Daniel, we'd have noticed that in chapter 1, these three people are consistently referred to in chapter 1 as youths. Then in chapter 2, they're consistently referred to as companions, friends. But the 9 times they're referred to in chapter 3, this chapter, they are always called men. And as we read through Daniel, we're meant to be seeing a progression that these three are growing up from youths to companions to men. God is growing them into mature human beings. The Bible says in Psalm 115 that you become like what you worship. And we see that principle played out powerfully in this passage. So those who make something impersonal their God, like money or pleasure, or in this chapter a 90-foot block of metal, they become less and less human in their behavior. But those who bow down before the living God are freed to become more and more like the people we were created to be, mature image bearers of our personal creator. So we can see this chapter is exposing for us the true nature of idolatry. Idols are subtle. They can reel us in without us even noticing. They're attractive. They're often outwardly very impressive. But they're ultimately enslaving. In fact, they gradually mold us into their image and they dehumanize us. So the point is, we need to be alert for idols. I hope we, if we're believers, I hope we're learning what particular idols we are vulnerable to, whether it's what others think of us or our to-do list or financial security or physical comfort or control or knowledge or whatever it is. But beyond knowing what the idols we're vulnerable to, we need to be learning to see through the idols. We need to be learning to recognize the falseness of their promises. But to stand for God against the world, we don't simply need to see the false gods for what they are. We also need to know the true God for who he is. These three men are facing a grisly death. They're about to be burned alive if they stand up for their faith. And the key thing that they understand about God, which enables them to take their stand, is that he is worthy. So look with me down at verse 16, chapter 3, verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king." So do you see there? There's no question here that God is powerful and that he loves to save his people from trouble. But if not, verse 18, "But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." And that final sentence there is very revealing. "But even if he doesn't save us, we will still serve God." Now, I don't think these men knew for sure what God was going to do. God is free. You know, he's not constrained or manipulated by what we think he should do. But what these men did know is that whether God saves them or not, he is still worthy of their worship. Sometimes people say, don't they, you know, "I trusted God, I lived a good life, but when I needed God, he didn't come through for me." But actually, that attitude reveals that they weren't really trusting God at all. They were actually trusting in their own agenda. That was the non-negotiable thing in their life. And God just was this convenient means for fulfilling that agenda. Now, of course, we hate it, don't we? If people use us like that, if people are only interested in us for what they might get out of us. But that is exactly how we treat God very often. Now, God loves, doesn't he, to give good gifts to his children. But he hasn't promised us a job that is satisfying. He hasn't promised us the spouse that we desire or the children that we've longed for. And true faith says in verse 18 that even if he doesn't give us what we want, he's still worthy of our worship, just for who he is. This God of infinite power and kindness and wisdom and beauty and glory. We haven't had time to look at the whole chapter this week. We'll be coming back to it next week. But you may already know that later in this chapter, these three friends survive the fiery furnace. They're made physically fireproof. But knowing that God is worthy of our worship, whatever the circumstance, that is what makes them spiritually fireproofed, even before they're physically fireproofed. For us, the cost of standing for God is probably not going to be a fiery furnace, thankfully. But it may well be being labelled as a bigot, or it might be being overlooked for promotion, or perhaps even losing our jobs. And the way we can be spiritually fireproofed against these attacks is growing in the conviction, in this conviction that God is worthy, whatever the situation. Now, as these three discovered, we usually don't get to pick the particular issue on which we have to stand out. For us, it might come to us, a question is thrown at us about what the Bible says about sexuality or whether other religions lead to God or whatever it is. And at that moment, we probably wish we could be talking about anything else, something much more positive, perhaps. And in addition to that, we fear that by saying something which we know is going to be unpopular in the culture, that actually we'll be making the gospel sound unattractive. Maybe we fear that we'll be losing credibility with that person. But this chapter shows us that that shouldn't be our chief concern, and that standing for the truth amidst opposition is actually, this is point three, how the battle is won. If you look at the structure of the chapter begins with what looks like the whole world bowing down to false gods. And the chapter ends, and this is beyond our verses, which we'll look at next week, with the emperor acknowledging the true God and then calling every people, nation and tongue to do the same, in verse 29. And it's worth asking, this is a good tip for reading biblical narrative, what is the turning point? You know, where do we begin, where do we end, and what makes the difference? What's the pivot? What is it that God uses to cause that shift? And the answer is, it's a handful of oddballs faithfully standing out from the crowd, even when it's costly. That's what makes the difference. If you were here at our prayer supper in November, you'll have heard Chris Howells, one of our mission partners, coming to speak to us. And he told us the story of how in 1886, the king of Buganda, as it was then called, he discovered that 24 of his servants had become followers of Jesus Christ. And he decided, he was quite a fiery bloke, and he decided to have them tied up and laid out on a bed of straw and wood. And he told them that if they wouldn't recant of their new faith, they would all be burned alive. Now, these were the only believers with any royal influence in that whole country. And they knew that all of that could be lost in a moment if they dug their heels in and were stubborn. But Chris told us how all 24 of them, some of them still only teenagers, they chose to take the hit and be burned alive rather than compromising their faith. And as a result of this brave stand that they took, the king himself in time turned to Christ. And if you know the history of that nation, you'll know that that is what opened the door to the gospel spreading very rapidly through Uganda. Being seen as odd and different may lose us credibility. It may lose us influence for a time. But in the Lord's grace, it's as we are faithful to him that God will build his kingdom. Revelation chapter 12 says this, "And they, the believers, have conquered Satan by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, for they loved not their lives even unto death." So as we start out on a new year, 2015, it's worth asking the question, how is it that the battle is won spiritually in this nation? What does this verse have to tell us? Well, it tells us it's not through clever strategizing. It's not through impressive events and programs. It's definitely not through compromising with the truth to try and gain credibility. The verse says the battle is won through faithful believers standing for the truth, whatever the cost. And that is what God will use to transform this world. We're going to have a time of quiet to reflect on this passage and what God's saying to each of us. And then when the musicians start, we'll stand and we'll sing the song that will come up on the screen.